If you refinance an FHA out, then you can go use an FHA again on another property. When I first found that, a light bulb just turned on. Like, that's the best and easiest way to create a real estate portfolio. I just don't want to talk in hypotheticals here. I actually did this, so I want to show you that it truly does work.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
What's going on? Welcome to the Multifamily Money Podcast. On today's Finance Friday episode, we're going to be talking about housing, where and how you live. There's been a topic of discussion that's kind of gained some heat in some circles of the real estate industry, and that is whether you should rent where you live or own where you live. And I'm sure some of you are like, what are you talking about? If you have the ability to own where you live, you should always own where you live. There's a certain part of that that I agree with, but then there's a certain part of that I don't. And where I don't agree with that is when people bring into the conversation that owning your primary residence is the best investment you can make. And I think that is a complete lie. And why I think that is because, to me, your residence isn't an asset until you sell it for a profit. And here's why. Because when you buy your residence, put in a down payment, so there goes that money into the property, then you're going to be paying for your mortgage, your taxes, your insurance, and your maintenance, among other things, to keep your property running and standing up. And to me, when you pump something into a quote-unquote asset, that's not an asset. You are putting money into it. And yes, when you go to sell it, then if you sell it for return, I consider it an asset. Then you might ask, well, Sean, what about a stock? You buy a stock, and if it's not a dividend paying stock, it's not paying you income. Wouldn't you not consider that an asset? No, because you buy that stock and then hopefully it appreciates over time and then you sell. But during that time that you hold it, you're not pumping more money into that unless you're buying more, but then you're buying more shares, more ownership. So that's completely different. Yes, a stock is an asset. But something, in my opinion, when you pump money into something that takes more of your money to run and then doesn't produce you income, that's not an asset. That's a liability. So that's why I do not think your primary residence is an asset. Now, yes, when you go to sell and make a profit, it can be. But when it comes to renting, I also understand the argument. You're just paying someone else to pay down their mortgage, and that you're never going to see that money again. So I completely agree with that. And I get the argument. It's all about comfort and risk tolerance. If you're more comfortable owning your own property and to you, it's less risky than just flushing your money down the toilet to a landlord. I get that. But I think there's a better option out there, and that's called house hacking. And for you that don't know what that is, simply, you're going to buy a 1-4 unit property. You're going to buy it generally with a mortgage. And then you're either going to have a roommate if it's a 1-unit property, or you're going to have tenants if it's a 2-4 unit property. And the reason why it can only be up to 4 units is because above 4 units, it's considered a commercial property and you can no longer can get residential loan, which has some benefits over a commercial, which I'll get into when we're talking about this size, this type of property. So if you want to get into it, then you buy that 1-4 unit, you bring in those tenants or roommates, and if you do it right, they will pay or exceed your mortgage payment. And oftentimes it'll pay for or exceed your mortgage, tax, and insurance. And that's so powerful. To me, that's an asset because, like a stock, yeah, you're not making any income if you're not bringing in over those payments, but you're not pumping any more money into it. So you're just holding the asset for the duration of your hold period. And then hopefully if you bought right, you'll make money. And so to me, that's an asset and that's really powerful. And how it gets even more powerful is using the residential loan, specifically an FHA loan. And that's because if you meet the criteria, you only have to put anywhere from 3.5% to 10% down. That's right, 3.5% to 10% down. So if we want to look at the criteria, how you qualify for that, you have to have a credit score of at least 580. That's so easy to get 580. When I looked at the criteria for the first time, I was shocked it was that low. But it shows why it's so important to build credit. And I'm going to have an episode later about why credit's important and how to build it. But as you can tell, this can make your life a lot easier and a lot cheaper if you have good credit. Because if you don't meet that credit score, then it's going to bump you all the way up to putting anywhere from 20 to 25% down. That's a game changer. If you have a $300,000 house, you'd have to put 20% down. You're putting like 60 grand plus closing costs. Whereas 3.5% down, you're putting somewhere around 9,000, 10,000. That's a massive difference. So also next, if you do have a credit score between 500 and 579, then the down payment bumps up to 10%. But anything below 500, then you're going to be put 20, 25% down if you even qualify. And usually if you would qualify for a different type of loan at that credit score, your rate's usually going to be really high. So also why it's super important to have good credit. And then they also look at when FHA, you get a what they call mortgage insurance premium. So it's a little bump onto your final mortgage payment. It's just because your down payment's so low. So they want a little higher premium just for a little more insurance. And then they also look at your debt to income ratio. So that's the relationship between, you know, how much you bring in from, say, your job compared to how much you pay out in debt per year. And they want to see that at 43% or lower. So they don't want the annual debt payments you pay to exceed 43% of your annual income. And then, like I mentioned earlier, this must be you as the borrower's primary residence. Usually you have to live in the property for at least 12 months. There's some that require 18 months, but generally it is 12 months. And then also as a borrower, you must have proof of steady income. So W-2 is usually the best way to show that you do have steady income. And another powerful thing about FHA too is what a lot of people don't know. And I didn't even know this until probably about 4 years ago, is that it's a first-time homebuyer loan. That's what the FHA loan is. And I thought, like I think many think, that you only can use that once. And that's not the case. You can only just have one out at a time. So the real power of house hacking is not only do you get to live in your primary residence and not, if you do it right, not pay, have it paid for you, but it's a great way to build a real estate portfolio, because if you live in that residence for 12 months, now you can refi into a traditional loan. And now you can move out, fill your unit or your room with another tenant. And one, now you're making money off of that property. And then two, you can go out and do the process all over again and use another FHA, because it's not that you can only use it once, it's that you can only have one out at a time. So if you refinance an FHA out, then you can go use an FHA again on another property. When I first found that out, the light bulb just turned on. Like, that's the best and easiest way to create a real estate portfolio. So I just don't want to talk in hypotheticals here. I actually did this. So I want to show you that it truly does work. So we'll talk a little bit about the numbers. So I bought a property for $315,000 and I wanted to use the FHA. Unfortunately, because I had other investment properties, these weren't my primary residence. These ones I just bought as investments. And I had vacancies in them because it was a value add play. So I was turning the units, improving the units. So the income in those properties wasn't there to support the debt payment. I was still able to pay the debt payment, but it threw my debt to income ratio out of whack. So I wish I had just waited, but we know how hot the market was in 2020. I didn't have the opportunity to wait. If I wanted this property, I had to get in now. So I was not able to use the FHA. So I had to put 20% down. I'm going to tell the numbers if I had done either or. So my mortgage payment after putting 20% down, and this includes taxes, insurance, is $1,762. And when I bought the property, the previous owner had one tenant in one of the units. It's a, should have mentioned, it's a duplex. So they had the tenant paying $1,600 for rent, which is way under market for the area. It should have probably been around $1,800. But still, I was very comfortable with that going in. You know, only $162 difference between what that tenant was paying and what I'd have to pay for my mortgage, taxes, and insurance. So their rent was exceeding my mortgage payment, but it was not exceeding taxes and insurance, but it was pretty darn close. So I was comfortable with that. Also knowing that within a year, I could bring the rent up and I would be fine. And then we can, between trash that I had to pay for myself and the other tenant and my own personal utilities, I was at about $200 of expenses. So that's a total of $362 that I was paying to live. I don't know about you, but if you're in a nice area and in a nice home, I don't know anyone who's paying $362 unless you're living in your parents' house and you're probably paying nothing. But anyways, since I used a 20% down payment, I didn't have to live in it for 12 months if I didn't want to. However, let's take a look. So initial cash investment, I'm sure you guys can do the math, 20% down, it's about $90,000, including the closing costs. And gross rental income is $45,000. Vacancy rate, the gross rental income is after I moved out and was cash flowing or had gross potential rental income of $3,750. And so that had gross rental income of $45,000. I always put vacancy at 6%. even though in this market, it's probably really rare that I would hit that, but I think it's just be conservative in that sense. Operating expenses, I usually just put in 11. I think it is less than that, but that's comfortable with putting 11% in operating expenses. Annual loan payment of $21,144, and that gives you cash on cash return of 18.34%. So after I had moved out, filled my unit with another tenant, I'm getting an 18% cash on cash return. Who's going to argue with that? And now I can go buy another one. But here's where it gets really powerful. If I had used an FHA loan, but 3.5% down, my cash on cash return would have been over 100%. Yes, over 100% on top of that. And then I also would have put less into it and wouldn't had to have saved as much to buy the next one. And then you could have gone on to your next one and your next one and your next one. And within 10 years, you could have 10 properties. If all 10 of those properties have net cash flow of $1,000, you're making 10 grand a month, $120,000 a year. I don't know too many people who would argue with that. But the only caveat to it is it's quality of life, right? So you got to be okay with managing tenants or roommates. And if you go the one unit route and you have roommates, there's kind of a scale. So the more uncomfortable living situation, the more profitability. So if you live in a one unit and you bring in roommates, your net cash flow, your cash on cash return is going to be a lot greater than if you have multiple units and tenants. And that just makes sense. And you can even have multiple units and do it in a roommate structure where you rent by room, including the other room in your unit. And it's just a scale. Like I said, the more uncomfortable the living situation is, more inconvenient the living situation is, the more profitability. And some people even do it this way, where they will buy one unit, like residential property, and they'll fill it with tenants, and then they'll live like in the driveway or the backyard in their camper. But then again, it's about inconvenience to profitability. Where do you want to be on that graph? So this, I don't know about you guys, but this topic has always gotten my juices flowing. And if you're thinking about buying a home, I would 100% urge you to take a look at this. Just such a powerful way to get in, to get into owning real estate. One, to have your own place to live. And then two, when you're done, to have something that's an investment that will pay you. There is a book out there that I'd recommend if anyone is interested in this that I use. It's by Bigger Pockets, and it's just called House Hacking. I would definitely use it, pretty much step by step, what you need to do, what systems they use, one, how to find a property, the financing aspect of it. Once you have the property, how to interview potential tenants, how to select the right tenant, background checks. That's another topic I want to talk about. So for my bigger properties that are just my investment properties, I have third-party property managers that have their own softwares that they use to manage. But for this one that I house hacked, I used apartments.com. Reason I did that is because it's an all-in-one solution. So when I have tenants, I have them create an account on apartments.com. I go in there, load the lease that they signed in there, and I also create the terms and conditions. So it'll be like their rent is X. They have 5 days to pay. If they don't pay within 5 days, this is their late fee. And they automatically, apartments.com automatically takes care of that and keeps everything on track. And they notify you when they've paid. And also a great thing about apartments.com too, is when you're looking for tenants, you tell them that they have to do a credit and background check. And that is all done through apartments.com and their profile. And they just go straight on there and they pay too. So you're not paying for that. It's about, I want to say $25 that they pay. That's industry standard. So it's not like I've never had one person like question me or argue or push back on that, because that everyone's doing that. So, and it's just great. Produces your report. It tells you their credit score, you know, if there's been any dings on their credit, and then also the background check as well, if they've had any criminal reports. And you're going to want to dig into that because that's very important. All right. Well, I don't want to take too much of your time today. Everyone have a great weekend. Next week, I'm going to be getting into a 6-part series just of what I think is the most important steps to take to achieve true financial freedom, meaning you have enough passive income coming in to support the type of lifestyle you want. And to me, that is true freedom, because it's not what you make, but what you keep and what you can give back to society. All right, everyone, have a good one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.